BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, with 29,000 young people, it's one of Britain's biggest universities. Last week, students took over a corner of one of the bars up at the French A campus of the University of the West of England. So, from the Core 24 bar, we hear this week what's driving these young people's programme of weekly action on the streets of Bristol. Back in the 1960s, US President John F. Kennedy tried to reform the money system, and some believe he was shot for his trouble. We look at the link between powerful private banking monopolies and what's become known to many as the New World Order. Plus, the BBC ain't what they used to be. Borrowed from last Sunday's dialect show, the Bard of Windmill Hill, Trevor Carter, may have blown his chances of appearing on Radio Bristol with a poem we'll hear before 7 o'clock entitled Appalling Standards. But first, you may not have realised it, but on Monday this week, the Department of Energy was in Bristol consulting you, asking you whether or not you want two new nuclear power stations at Hinkley and Oldbury. Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth's Bristol office is here to tell us how it went. Hi, Mike, and welcome to Drive
Hello,
Time.
Hello, Tony, thank you.
Now, can you tell us what happened on Monday and whereabouts was the hearing held?
It was held in a building called Telephone House, I think it is, just off of Baldwin Street. The security was pretty thorough, actually, so unless you had your invitation and a bit of ID, you didn't get in the building. Nevertheless, quite a large number of protesters from the Hinckley area and Somerset in particular managed to get themselves into the meeting and pretty much dominated the proceedings, I have to say. So at the end,
but isn't that a bit counterproductive possibly, because the whole idea surely is to for the government to be able to consult about this, to listen to what people have got to say, and it may be that they're only just hearing one side of the argument.
I think there were representatives of industry there, but I don't know that they have really to come to a consultative meeting in Bristol in order to get their voices heard in the corridors of power in the Department of Energy. I think they've got pretty much the inside track. So this was the chance for the rest of us to have a say.
So this is a bit of a one-sided thing there. It was really people who are campaigning against it rather than having both sides at this part of this consultation.
There was a contribution. There are some people, obviously there's a lot of people who are working or have worked in the nuclear industry down at Hinkley before, and there is, you know, a feeling that keeping the nuclear industry on site down there is going to secure jobs for the future. So yeah, there's a legitimate argument there that was heard as well.
What sort of things were being discussed then as part of the consultation? What were the main arguments?
It was mostly around the way in which the government is going to manipulate energy policy in future to allow industry to build large power stations, basically. And they seem to be trying to make it as easy as possible, open the door for the industry, be it nuclear, gas-fired, incinerators, very large-scale wind farms. You know, basically, they're trying to sort of clear obstacles out of the path to allow industry to bring forward as many proposals as they want to.
And so what does this mean for the environment?
Well, our difficulty with this whole process is the government is actually not setting any sort of clear guidelines, and they're not saying that we should prioritise the renewable forms of energy over nuclear or coal or gas or anything else. They're basically just saying, you know, bring it on, whatever it is, we want you to build it.
I mean, one of the ways they're framing this is saying, well, actually, nuclear is zero carbon, Mike.
Yeah, if you do the whole sum for everything involved in getting some electricity out of a nuclear station, from getting the uranium out of the ground to the sort of tens of thousands of years you have to look after the waste afterwards, then it's not quite so zero carbon as you might be led to believe. But I mean, the carbon, of course, is only part of the issue around nuclear power. And yeah, okay, so there's a benefit there in terms of reducing carbon emissions, but a lot of people coming there from Hinckley and Oldbury were very concerned at the prospect that they'll have to be intensively radioactive waste stored on site for 160 years after the power stations are finished operating.
So what are these sites going to look like if and when they're built, and how big are they compared to the existing sites?
I think pretty huge, actually. I mean, it depends what the industry actually comes forward with, but that's another thing that people, I think, perhaps haven't really cottoned on to, because there's a feeling like, well, we've had nuclear power in this area for 50 years, those stations have been there all this time, but actually the scale of what the new proposals are that are coming forward is for much larger stations, complexes, whole nuclear complexes on these sites, because you've got bigger power stations, more of them, and you've also got the need to look after the radioactive waste for many generations afterwards on site.
Well, now, so how is the process going to be taken on after the discussions on Monday?
The government will. This is the second time they've done the consultation. The second time they've introduced.
What, on the same power stations?
On the same sites, yes, because they didn't do it properly the first time.
Really?
And
they
received a letter from our lawyers and others explaining that they hadn't carried out the consultation in accordance with the.
So, what had they actually done wrong in the first time?
Well, they hadn't really looked at the alternatives, basically. That was what they hadn't done, and the law requires them to do is to actually justify what they propose to do by saying these are the other things that we might do, and this is why we've chosen to do it.
Well, it does sound a little bit blinkered, I have to say, for them not even to be thinking about just saying, well, look, this is what we're going to do and we're going to consult on it. And, you know, you do wonder whether some of these consultations are just a paper exercise.
I think it's clearly driven by a desire to get these nuclear stations through and get them through as quickly as possible. And, the consultation is a sort of stage that they feel they have to go through, but I don't think there's really any doubt as to what they want. You know, the conclusions are already written.
Martin, what are your thoughts about new nuclear and how necessary it might be and how it fits in economically? Because I know nuclear, at least the power stations of the past, have proved to be very expensive, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, as the campaign is saying the other week, who were on here, there's cost overruns. When they say it's going to cost so much, they've got a track record of massive cost overruns on the production of nuclear power stations. So, it may be that it's not nearly as economic as it's being suggested.
Doesn't that happen right across the development industries?
No, I think nuclear power in particular has a reputation for cost overruns. And, of course, the looking after the waste has to be taken over by the government, because no private sector institution is prepared to take the risk of looking after nuclear waste.
Well, I see you nodding there, Mike. Is that true, that we, the public, are going to be having to really take over the responsibility for the waste whilst these nuclear power companies reap the rewards and benefits of selling that electricity?
That is the track record of the way the government has handled the nuclear industry over the preceding decades. They've always been very clever about allowing initially it was a state-run industry. Of course, it was a state-owned company that built nuclear power stations in Britain. But over since the days of Thatcher, they've gradually changed it so that the private sector is getting the cash reward from selling the electricity to the grid, but the liabilities are being taken on by the state. In other words, by us taxpayers into the future.
But I mean, once the nuclear power stations close down, that's it, isn't it? Where there's no liabilities from there.
Well, there is, if the waste lasts for thousands of years. I mean, that's precisely what the private sector doesn't want to take on board.
We do hear this, Mike, that the waste, Marcia just said, the waste lasts for thousands of years. But, I mean, surely you can just bury it out of the way, and it doesn't really matter how long the waste is still radioactive if it's buried.
Nobody's ever done that anywhere yet in the world. They've never actually built and operated as a secure waste facility. So, this is stuff that has started being generated by the nuclear weapons program in the US in the 1940s. And so we're now 60 years into operating nuclear power, and we still haven't actually cracked a safe, secure storage system.
I think it's absolutely significant that the free market will not take on this nuclear waste. I mean, in other spheres, when the market announces something like you've got to cut your education budget by 20%, people say, oh, well, you can't buck the market. In this case, we do buck the market. Why would that be? In actual fact, I think that we're being given a false prospectus of the economics of nuclear power all the time.
Mike, where is the nuclear waste being stored? I'm starting to get a little bit nervous biting my nails here. You're saying that it's not able to be stored underground and buried. So what's happened to all the nuclear waste that's been being produced in Britain since the 1950s?
Yes, so far the highly radioactive stuff has been taken up to Sellafield on the coast of Cumbria, and it's stored there in tanks which have to be kept cool all the time because it's generating heat.
So these fuel rods are still hot?
Well, I understand that these particular nuclear power stations that are being built, they're going to store the stuff on site, aren't they?
That's not
going to move it around.
That means
that we're going to have Sellafield on our doorstep.
Is that actually a better thing to do that, do you think, rather than be transporting the stuff around, Mike?
I think you must multiply the chances of something going wrong. The more of these places that you have that you store the nuclear waste, then obviously the more chance that one of them will in one way or another fail.
Now, also, there's an energy bill coming along next week, which is about home insulation. So at least some good news. This is from the LibCon Alliance, one of their new programmes that they're bringing in and announcing next week.
Yeah, that's right. There's an energy bill coming out next week, and some as part of that is going to be what they call the Green Deal. And yeah, if you are hard pushed, that's a good news story. The government is going to put some serious funding into encouraging homeowners to insulate their property. It's going to make access to finance and to grants easier for a lot of people to do that. But actually, on a scale that is really tiny compared with the scale of the problem, we don't know yet. We'll have to see the detail next week. But the scale of program the government is likely to announce means that we won't have all our housing stock brought up to a decent standard for hundreds of years. And then there is the issue that actually this is the Green Deal is targeted at people who own their homes.
Now, just a minute. People who own their homes are much more likely to be able to afford to insulate their homes than people who don't. So what's the point of targeting homeowners with this aid?
They just haven't yet thought about how they're going to be able to help people in rented accommodation to reduce their energy needs. And of course, they're the people who are most likely to be the ones who are suffering from fuel poverty, having to spend too much of their monthly budget on keeping themselves warm.
Martin, how important do you think this whole issue of insulation is? At least it seems good that the LibCons have bitten the bullet here, and at least they're doing something about insulating people's homes, because we're talking regularly here about one of the problems with energy being that we actually use too much, and of course some of it is just literally being, you know, sort of leaking out through the windows, leaking out through the cracks in the doors, this kind of thing, and keyholes, all that stuff.
Well, yes, I mean, and a step has been taken in the right direction here, and credit where it's due, it's a step in the right direction. I mean, my attitude towards the current government, if you like, is when they do things that are good, we should just say, yes, that's good. And I don't suppose, I imagine if there had been a Labour government, that similar measures would have been brought in.
That's very likely, yes.
I mean, I think the obvious, in the long run, as I've mentioned before, Amory Lovins is a scientist, a physicist. He runs the Rocky Mountain Institute. I've mentioned this before. People can probably look it up on the internet, but he wrote a very good paper about this, which I circulated in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, where he pointed out that most of our energy problems are overuse problems. So instead of building nuclear power stations, for a fraction of the money you spend on building a nuclear power station, you could reduce the energy need of the society by things like insulation and retrofitting all of your kit so that it is energy efficient, and in actual fact you then reduce your energy footprint, and therefore you don't have to spend so much money on producing new sources of energy. And of course the beauty of this is that the technology for efficient use of energy is already exists. We don't have to invent a new technology here. We just have to give our scientists a brief, which is we want all of our kit, whatever it is, to be absolutely energy efficient. And that's the sort of thing which our scientists can go, oh yes, we can do that for you, and they can do it for us. But of course, to make that transition will not just happen via the market. It will require a push by government and some intervention and some investment. But then that's what we need to deal with the economic crisis anyway.
Yeah.
So Mike, does Friends of the Earth have a policy on this?
Yeah, I mean, we do applaud the fact that the government is coming forward with this Green Deal, but it needs to be on a much bigger scale.
One thing I don't understand is why it is possible to target homeowners but not possible to target people in rented accommodation. I don't understand why. Everybody can't be targeted. Mm. What's the point of that?
Yeah, what's the point of targeting the people, as you say, probably those least in need and most able to afford it? So it's not a very smartly targeted programme.
Quite smartly targeted from a political point of view, I may suggest.
Yes.
These are the people that vote.
Yes. I think you could be, or yes, vote for a certain party. Yeah. I mean, I think Martin's quite right that most of what we have to has to be done, we know how to do, but there are technical issues here. I mean, like most of the houses in Bristol, the majority of houses in our city actually don't have cavity walls, which is a problem for making a property really energy efficient. You've got to do something about heat leaking out through the walls, which means either you put an extra layer inside or outside the building, and you've got to find ways of being able to do that whole street at a time. But you know, that's not beyond our wit, and it requires a major program like local council to invest in just taking a whole area and doing it for all the houses in that area on one go. That's the kind of scale we need to be thinking
of. But I'm afraid the local authorities are reining back on all this stuff, aren't they? So what's likely to be in this bill next week?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bristol's doing its best to keep going with the programme, step up the size of the programme they already have. They're trying to borrow money, and we could be seeing some innovative things coming in with things like local authorities having their own bond issues so that people can actually invest in the city that they live in. But, you know, that's a little way down the track yet. So basically at the moment we've just got this Green Deal on offer from central government, which in terms of either alleviating the problem of people on low incomes freezing in their houses or actually cutting the emissions, it's not the best targeted it could be.
Now, there's also an international climate conference next week. Now, do you know anything about that?
I have heard something about this. This has been kind of really talked down in a very disappointing way by, we're having our expectations managed to not expect any positive outcome from this. So it's not a happy prospect what's likely to come out of the negotiations at Cancun. It's not going to move us forward for what is really desperately needed, a replacement for or a continuation of the Kyoto Protocol.
So does Friends of the Earth have a policy for Cancun?
Yeah. I mean, we want to see an international agreement, everybody signing up to legally binding targets to reduce carbon emissions, but with the much the greatest proportion of that burden taken by the developed world, who've caused the problem, have got most wealth to tackle it, and it's the developing countries who really sit there in fear of what is going to happen. I noticed that the president of Mexico made a direct appeal to the leaders of the developed world to come down to Cancun and get these climate talks sorted out, and David Cameron goes on a plane and flies off to Zurich instead.
So why is it that it's so difficult, it seems, at these conferences to get agreement? Is it simply that many of the consumers in the West just simply don't want to put up with these kind of restrictions on car use and things like that?
I don't think it's got anywhere near to what actually the electorates and the consumers think. Governments are afraid of having to intervene in ways that lower our expectations of just being able to consume everything, more and more of everything all the time. There is a fear amongst politicians of ever mentioning that they might have to do something like that. But I think more, it's closer to the truth, is just to say that the very, very powerful vested lobbying interests are getting to the governments first. So it's the fossil fuel industries, it's oil, coal, gas, and it's the car manufacturers. I mean, we had a very clear instance last year with the German government sort of failing to agree a European target to reduce carbon in line with what scientists are telling us needs to happen, but because of lobbying from their own large car industry.
Well, they've got the biggest car industry in Europe, haven't they? So they must.
Well, they've also got a car industry that specialises in building large cars.
Martin, what about the economics of this?
I understand the position of Friends of the Earth is that you're not in favour of carbon trading, and I think that's what's messed up a lot of the discussion about this, because carbon trading is basically, let's have another bubble that we can mess around with. And of course, from a hedge fund point of view, this is a perfect bubble, because it's like musical chairs. The carbon trading is going to be lowered down year by year by year, so these things that you're trading are going to go up in value guaranteed. And of course, it's a market solution to the problem. And of course, many people in the third world just don't believe in this kind of way of managing things.
Yeah.
And they've basically said that we're not signing up for that. If the West is serious about reducing carbon emissions, they've got to deal with the issues from the developing world. Quite rightly says, look, you emitted as what you emitted to make whatever progress you made over several generations, and you can't turn around to us and say we can't.
Yeah.
We are prepared to negotiate about this, but if you're serious about this, then you'll have to show us the money.
Yep.
And of course, at that point, they've got something better to do, to go to Zurich or whatever. Now, if that's the way of it, then nothing's going to happen about this. It's just going to drift on, isn't it?
What's your thoughts about the LibCon coalition's progress so far environmentally? Because obviously, you're not particularly approving of Mr. Cameron's disinterest in this climate conference, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, everything you've got to sort of take, as Martin was saying, give credit where it's due, and when government takes steps in the right direction, when individual politicians start to move as well, you know, you've got to kind of give them credit for that and show that there's, you know, there's benefit for them in doing that. But they haven't given us a lot to go on yet, to be honest. I mean, we've got, we started off talking about very disappointing progress on national big-scale energy policy, where government just seems to be doing, you know, all it can at the behest of big industry to allow them to build more power stations of whatever kind they want. You know, a less good than it could be Green Deal likely to come out next week about home insulation. So I don't think the government's actions so far have really got anywhere near matching their rhetoric about being the greenest government ever.
So let's go back, I think, before we finish, let's go back to where we started, which was this nuclear, the potential new large, you know, even up to 250-acre nuclear sites at Hinkley and Oldbury. What's the next stage in the process with all that? Now the government's been to Bristol, done its little consultation. You know, where is that whole project going, and when are we going to know for certain? How long until we know for certain whether these power stations are going to be built or not?
Yeah, I think that the programme, the timetable is already slipping. So the prediction was that EDF, the French-owned nuclear company that wants to build the big reactors at Hinkley, would come forward with their application in March next year. I don't think they're going to be able to meet that timetable. It will slip back to later in the year. Once they get that, once they make that application, it goes to a quango in Bristol called the Infrastructure Planning Commission. They say, okay, the paperwork's in order, you know, we'll hear this application. Then they got a year to decide. So it could be, you know, back end of 2012 that we actually get a decision. Don't forget, there was a decision that went against the local communities to build a third nuclear power station at Hinkley back in the 1980s, but it never got built.
One thing we've heard from the campaigners who've been on here over the last few weeks is that actually some of the two companies that are thinking of building these power stations have actually been doing activities on the site, on the sites before they've actually got planning permission. This has rather irked the local people before they've got planning permission. Do you think actually there's anything in that? Is that really a bit cheeky of these power companies, or do they need to be actually doing stuff on site?
I can't see there's any justification for doing that. I mean, if they haven't got the permission, they shouldn't be undertaking these huge works. EDF, I understand, have got a planning application coming before the District Council, Sedgemoor District Council, pretty soon. May already be in fact, to do absolutely massive groundworks down there, moving more earth than they had to move to build the Olympics site in London. So that's a huge proposal. They've got planning permission to build the power station. God. This is just the preparing the ground.
Martin, what are your thoughts about whether this is, what do you think, is this going to happen or not?
I suspect it may not happen, because the economic crisis is going to lead to a situation where these big projects may not be funded. Also, of course, we were arguing earlier that we need to spend more money to stimulate the economy. And so you could argue that it's worth subsidising something like this, a big project like this, in order to create jobs. And also with technology like nuclear power, if it was safe, you'd want to actually, you know, break out of your, you invest in something like that in order to try and create a whole new generation of possibilities. But I think nuclear power is not a very good bet for that. We could actually get a lot more bang for our buck by spreading that money around, yeah, and doing a lot more energy efficiency, yeah, and that makes a lot more sense than having a huge mega project which may just turn out to be a white elephant.
Finally then, Mike, can you tell us about Friends of the Earth meetings and contact details?
Yeah, sure. We're just about to, we're meeting next week to draw up our programme for 2011, and we're looking to run many more public meetings than we have done over the last year, so stand by for news of that. But we're meeting monthly in 35 King Street in the centre of town. You can contact us on Bristol 942 0129, and you can find us on the web. Look for www.foe.co.uk and find your local group.
Okay, on that wonderful Bristol number, 942 0129, Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth's Bristol office, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.
We're going to hear in a moment about the students up at the University of England, West of England, after.
Yo. These are the steps that we need to take
to build for our future, for the next generation. Nate, Cyclonius, and Dark Matter. Let's build a new foundation, start with communication. And if you're on this team, you're on the same vibration. Only then can we create something amazing. Identity is the key with the right education. I'm sick of sitting waiting, we need a bunch of brave men who can stand up and look into the eyes of Satan. Or any corporation, or anyone that's hating, or anything that's blocking us from our destination. Teach the youth the truth about who they are. They're not gangsters or hoes, they're all superstars. We need some unity, no one in a different class. You wanna know your future, get to know your past. Grow our own food so we can get the minerals. Illegalize anything that stops us being spiritual. Kill the television so the children can't be fooled. Raise them in a household, that's where they should all be schooled.
You're sick and tired of living this way. And honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than always. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in vain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
This is for the youth on the road that wanna grow, that wanna live past 30 and circle the globe. The only guarantee you receive from life is death. So if we're gonna live, we might as well live it the best. Watch the thoughts that you keep, cause they always manifest. Follow steps from the ancestors to help your quest. My life's blessed, cause I find inner peace, minus the stress from the things I don't need. Be the ruler of your destiny, control your legacy. Build with your brother if he brings good energy. Wolves and sheep's clothing only bring treachery. Never follow fashion, set the pattern for the remedy. Real friends will always be, fake ones will come around. Glued to the screen like a theme, fam, only Dan. I love the next gen, so I put the pad to pen. The flower needs to stem from the start to the end.
Sick and tired of living this way. And honestly, down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than a waste. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
Have to build like the structures with the mortar. Free like the sun, moon, stars and the waters. Have your fathers, raising families with sons, wives and daughters. Slaves free your troubled minds, escaping all your quarters. In this new age of man-made days that are so crazed. Have to hold your sanity, we're on the last page. Open book that's everlasting. Minutes keep on passing while my seatbelt is fastened. In my mind I'm asking, does this man-made powerhouse cover us with any doubts? As I put a split resting on my mouth. This is a land of insecurities. There's no assurity that any cure would be the way to see us fall and free. Gotta be or you can be. Positive mentality is the only way that we will thrive in this reality. But certain man that's told up know what time it is. Making differences and changing life by how they really live.
You're sick and tired of living this way. And honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than a waste. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's why we're trying to build with our brothers today. You're sick and tired of living this way. And honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than a waste. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
Nate FT, Cyclonius and Dark Matter. That was released just a couple of weeks ago, and that was called Building, that song. Now, with 29,000 young people, it's one of Britain's biggest universities. Last week, students took over a corner of the Core 24 bar up at the University of the West of England's French A campus. Martin and I visited them there earlier this week. Now, Martin, can I just ask you for your impressions of what the students are up to?
Well, I mean, as we had one of their lecturers on this programme, was it last week or the week before, saying that they've behaved very responsibly. They are showing their opposition to the fees increase and the attacks on higher education. And basically, what they're doing is having a little camping, if you like, in the cafeteria or bar there. They're not being disruptive. It's just creating a focal point for their resistance.
Anyway, before we hear from the University of the West of England, the students across the country held a national conference last Sunday. And one of the most impressive speakers at their conference was only 15 years old.
This was meant to be the first post-ideological generation, right? This was meant to be the generation that never thought of anything bigger than our Facebook profiles and our TV screens. This was meant to be the generation where the only thing that Saturday night meant was X Factor. I think now that claim is quite ridiculous. I think now that claim is quite preposterous. I think now we've shown that we are as ideological as ever before. Now we've shown that solidarity and comradeship and all those things that used to be associated with students are as relevant now as they've ever been. You know, the most incredible thing that happened on Wednesday, I went down, I thought I was going to go down in lunch break and then get back in time for lessons. Perhaps I should have known they'd put the guy in charge of the G20 in charge. Perhaps I should have been more concerned for my life than for whether I was going to get down for lessons. But when I tried to get out and I was told it was a sterile area by police officers standing and not letting anyone out, I thought, well, that's why we need a university education. If we don't get one, we end up in police uniforms. You know, when I was kettled in there, I was with thousands and thousands of school students who'd come down with their ties around their heads in their school uniforms, and yeah, they were cold, who'd come down, who'd never been on a protest before, who'd never joined a political party or been involved in a political movement before, who didn't have any economic knowledge or political degrees, but they were there because they believed in something. They were there because they believed in something bigger, and they were there because they knew that either... You know, there weren't a million choices, there were two choices. Either they laid down and took whatever the government threw at them, or they stood up and fought back. And so those school students who'd never been involved in anything before stood up and they fought back. And when they were in that kettle, being kettled in by police, you know, the word went round as we were sitting, huddling around fires, sharing out what little food we had, and the word went round, people said, we know what they're up to. We know that they don't think we're a danger to the public. I'm 15 years old, people there were as young as 13. We know they don't think we're going to run riot through the streets of London. We know what they're up to. They think that if they kettle us now, we're not going to come on a demonstration ever again. Well, let the word go out from today, people said. Let the word go out about next Tuesday. Let the word go out about next week and next month and next year that they can't stop us demonstrating. They can't stop us fighting back. And however much they try to imprison us in the streets of London, those are our streets, and we will always be there to demonstrate. We will always be there to fight. People who had always thought that the police were just those people at the other end of the telephone line to help if there was a burglary. People who'd always thought that the media were just those friendly newspaper men who were there to give them that unbalanced picture of the facts. People learnt a lot last Wednesday. People learnt a lot as they huddled around fires and then emerged from that kettle to see headlines like vandals on the Evening Standard that afternoon. People learnt a lot when a police van was left in the middle of the road so that the police could tow it away and show the whole public, look what vandals these people are. People learnt a lot. So the message that goes out from last Wednesday is very clear. We are no longer that post-ideological generation. We are no longer that generation that doesn't care. We are no longer that generation that's prepared to sit back and take whatever they give us. We are now the generation at the heart of the fight back. We are now the generation that will stand with everyone who's fighting back. The most inspiring thing, I think, was that just after Wednesday, hundreds of people joined a Facebook group, school students joined a Facebook group in solidarity with RMT members on strike. Those are people who previously thought tube strikes were something annoying because they stopped them getting into school. Now they think they've got to link arms and fight back with everyone. So we want to show solidarity with everyone who's fighting back. We hope you'll show solidarity with us and send a strong message to this government that they can't throw their cuts at us. We're going to stand up and we're going to fight back.
Well, from the National Student Conference last weekend, that's one student, unnamed, who is only 15 years old, speaking at the conference last weekend. Martin, that's a pretty impressive from a 15-year-old, isn't it?
Yes, I wonder what political ambitions that young fellow has. It's good to hear. I think what was interesting to pick up on was the thing about the van, because that's what we heard up at UWE as well.
This is the police van.
The police van, which was vandalised, had no number plates on it and was left sort of in the middle of the demonstration. I don't think that the police should be playing games like that with demonstrators.
What, you're saying that the police, you think, left it there deliberately?
I think they left it there deliberately in the hopes that somebody would trash it. And I've seen that happen before, actually, on a anti-globalisation demonstration quite a few years ago now. And it was quite clear what was going on. The police were actually encouraging vandalism so to discredit the protesters.
Yeah, that's a pretty big accusation you're making there, Martin. Encouraging aggravation at demos?
What they're hoping to do, it's the two two things that are being suggested here is, A, they've left the van there so that they said it's an inviting target for protesters, and then of course they might video them smashing the van and perhaps catch them later. And the second thing is that by kettling they're hoping to deter people from demonstrating. I mean, there is questions about whether kettling is a legal tactic by the police. I don't want to see developing in this country the kind of hostility between police and demonstrators that we've seen, for example, in Greece, or as we used to see regularly in Ireland. And I used to live in Brixton during the 1980s, and there was a lot of antagonism between young people and the police.
But kettling is becoming a standard tactic, isn't it?
It is. And I think the police need to ask themselves a question. It's very important that the police are seen to be non-political, and if they start being seen to be sticking their fingers into the political process in order to steer it in a certain direction, then they will have to bear the consequences of that in terms of the hostility of young people.
Because of course the problem with a kettle is that even if you were just about planning to go home, you can't do it. You're stuck in a kettle.
Absolutely, and especially if it's freezing cold and you've got no food and you've got no water and all the rest of it.
Well, no toilets. I mean, you know,
the police apparently did provide toilets eventually at one stage, apparently. Nevertheless, I mean, obviously the police are overreacting to their under-policing of the previous demonstration where people got into the Conservative Party headquarters and so on, which of course is a legitimate tactic. To go and occupy Conservative Party headquarters is a legitimate tactic, but breaking things and potentially hurting people, I don't think those are legitimate tactics. So we've got to try and get the balance right here. People have a right to demonstrate and the police have got to facilitate that right, not to try and block it or thwart it, you know. And they need to have a word with themselves. And I think it's not. I mean, we understand that the guy who was responsible for the death at the G20 protest is going to be prosecuted, or some kind of internal disciplinary process is going to take place. Now, there has to be more than just an internal disciplinary protest. You know, if somebody died there because of police. Basically, police brutality. The guy wasn't a threat. He shouldn't have been hit by the baton. Totally unacceptable. And I don't want to see us go down the road where we're ending up with running fighting going on between police and young people. And in the 80s, that's definitely what the mood was. I lived in Brixton during both of the riots. I was involved in the miners' strike. And at that stage, the police were very much seen by, not just by young people, but by many people, as being on the side of the government. And I think the police need to actually have a word with themselves. It's not in their interest to be seen to be on the side of the government. They should be on the side of peaceful protest, and they should be facilitating peaceful protest, not trying to thwart it.
Because one of the things that you've been saying regularly, Martin, on this show is that people should be able to trust their local police forces. For example, if they've got suspicions about potential terrorist activity, that those are the people that people should be talking to.
Indeed, and therefore it's necessary if the police want to retain the trust of young people, they've got to show that they are not being partisan or partial in the way in which they deal with their protests and their ideas.
Well, up at the University of the West of England earlier this week, I wanted to know what's behind the Young People's Programme of Weekly Action on the streets of Bristol. So I spoke first to students Patrick Basarius and Mark Saville.
Hi, my name is Patrick Basarius. I'm one of the students currently occupying UWE as part of the anti-cuts and tuition fee rise movement. We're here just to sort of protest, show our anger to our university, and also to help sort of not educate, but help give more information to fellow students who may not know the ins and outs of what we're facing here at the moment, and how bad it's going to get. And we're sort of in a position where we can see that coming, and we just want everyone to be aware of, you know, how this is going to happen.
But are you going to be able to actually change the policy? Because that's what's crucial, isn't it? It's all very well making people aware, but what if you don't actually make an impact?
Well, I think the fact that the Lib Dems are now considering abstaining from the education bill, from the cuts bill that the Tories are putting through, I think that's a massive indicator that we are having an effect, and that bodies on the street, you know, feet on the ground, are making an impact. I mean, the fact that, you know, Vince Cable is not going to vote on his own proposal is a huge indicator that we are having an effect, and that more is needed, because they are cracking. Well, I'm studying politics here at UWE, and as of next year, I do believe, my course is being cut. The government funding for that course is being cut by 100%, so it'll be subsidised entirely by the university. That will obviously lead to a complete drop in quality, class sizes increasing, facilities being reduced, contact time being massively cut. And I think it's an absolute outrage that the humanities and the arts are being treated in this way, just because they're not money-making subjects, just because they're not engineering, just because they're not architecture, just because there's no direct employment straight off the back of it means it's not worthy, and I think that's an absolute outrage.
Now, if you were a politician, you would have to be making some of these difficult decisions. So where would you get the money from for to actually pay for these tuition fees so that the students didn't have to take loans out?
I think this is actually a fallacy. I mean, if you look around the world, it's not a case of there is no money. I mean, the governments of America and Japan have got a higher ratio of GDP to debt than we do. And I mean, if you look, and our ratio is somewhere around 80%, I do believe, at the moment. After the Second World War, our ratio of GDP to debt was 144%. And in the 5 years after the war, we created the welfare state, free education, free dentistry, and you know, such as that. So it's not a case there is no money. There is always money. The fact that these cuts are actually a conservative, there's an ideological basis for these cuts, and they lie within conservatism itself.
So what do you mean by ideological cuts?
The conservative ideology is to minimise the public sector and maximise the private sector, and that has been seen throughout the governments that have been of this ideology in the last 50 years. I mean, you know, Thatcher before this government, and it's exactly the same thing. It's not a case there is no money, it's a case that the conservatives want to finally put the nails into the public sphere. They finally want to put those final few nails in that Thatcher started with in the 80s, and you know, they're doing a very good job of it. You start with education, you get a populace that doesn't know exactly what's going on. Once you take away, you know, the education from that, you further lead to that down that road, and you're going to have a population that, you know, reads the media, listens to what is told, reads the Daily Mail, and doesn't stand up. And that's the first step in this road, by taking out the intellectuals of the society.
My name is Paul Saville, sociology and criminology student, third year. We've been occupying this on our 10th day now. It's really, really exciting. When we started out, you know, we kind of barricade ourselves into a corner, and it's a private property cafe we've occupied, and we've kind of slowly taken over more and more space, trying to incorporate our kind of political message with a kind of normal cafe scenario.
Now, you've got lots of food, and you're doing tea here in competition with the official UE bar over there.
Yeah, they normally charge £1.50 for a cup of tea, and we've, from when we moved in, if you like, we've started to say free tea and coffee, invite people over for a chat, which is really great because it engages with people. And I think they've realised that they've been losing a lot of money from that, and I think that's something that we can really look at is the financial side of things is what universities run on, and if we can kind of attack that, then it's starting to shake.
Now, I've also seen even some tents put up, indoor tents being put up in there. Are people actually sleeping here?
Yeah, there's normally upwards of about 15 people a night, and we've kind of got a shift rota going on so we don't get exhausted. I spent 3 days running around like a headless chicken with no sleep, just wasn't effective. And so basically you've got kind of a movement of people who stay and then go and get one of their lectures and things like that. Obviously we're here for an education, so we're not going to miss lectures and things, so it's great. Kind of the politics aside, when I first came to UE 3 years ago, there was nothing going on. It was very apathetic.
Well, you've got a student union here, haven't you?
We have, indeed, we have. I'm not sure if it's a union anymore. That's an interesting one. Not overly impressed with what our student union has come out and, like, basically what they haven't said, actually. They haven't said a lot. So we're kind of leading the campaign ourselves, which is great. It's about the students, and it's going really well so far.
Now, who in Bristol, in the Bristol area, have you got your eyes on? Is it just simply the Lib Dem MPs?
I think it's also ourselves. Looking at ourselves, why do we allow these kind of things to happen? They tell us that there's no other option, there's no money left. Well, there was money left when the bankers' bonuses were paid out and stuff, and then suddenly we're told we're all in it together. It's the system, for me, that we're looking to change. Not government, but system change, not government change.
And so what impact is this having on the majority of students? Because actually, you know, of all the numbers of students at University of the West of England, this is a tiny, tiny number.
We've got one of the largest student populations in the country, around 29,000, 30,000, something like that. We've had a lot of petitions signed and stuff, and there's a couple of people who have come and said, oh wow, I wanted to watch Sky Sports, or why isn't Sky News on anymore? But the majority of people have just been like, wow, you know. And it's actually created a kind of community idea which wasn't here before. So yeah, I think people are really in support of that, and pleased that someone at last is standing up and saying, no, we won't accept this.
But surely ultimately you're just simply going to have to, you don't have the money to pay these student fees.
I'm old school. I still believe in free education. I think that all the money we spend on wars and defence each year, perhaps if we spent all the money that we spend on killing people instead of educating, feeding and clothing the poor of the world, which would many times over, we could change the world and explore inner and outer space. And that's something that I hold really true to my heart. It's an exciting time, and I think this is also not just about the cuts, this is also about revolution. I think this is a revolutionary time.
Surely this is just idealism. Education now is something that society can't afford to pay for, and you are going to have to pay for it as you benefit from it.
Again, it's for me, I study sociology, and it's about like knowing things. It's about understanding and criticizing and being critical about the world around us. So for me, education isn't about going on to get a degree, to get a job in the market and stuff like that. Yeah, okay, it is partly, but there is also another element of education which is about just learning for learning's sake, rather than going out, getting a job, paying off your £35,000, you know, projected debt.
But you can still get your education in the future. It's just that you will have a debt at the end of it. That's the only difference.
I mean, this is the other thing. I was just saying to someone earlier today, actually, we were kind of having a bit of a debate about that. For me, it's also about control in society. I mean, say, for example, they're looking at £8,000 tuition fees at UE from 2012. Now, times up by 3 years, undergraduate degree, that's £24,000. That's just for the tuition fees. Then you put accommodation on top of that and food for the 3 years. You're probably looking, I imagine, like 34,000. So 24 plus 10,000 for accommodation, 34,000. Now, let's say, for example, you meet another student while you're at uni, you decide to get together. As a joint debt, you've got £70,000 worth of debt before you've even started your proper working life.
That was Mark Saville there. Before him, Patrick Basarius up at the University of the West of England on the French A campus, speaking to me earlier this week.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, French former footballer Eric Cantona has a campaign going against the banks right now. He says that on 7th of December, everyone should withdraw their money from the banks. Now, there's a similar campaign being run by former Wall Street stockbroker Max Keiser for everybody to buy silver and crash JP Morgan. So, firstly, Martin, is there any point to these campaigns?
Well, there is, but one has to, you know, it's a question. I mean, it's telling people to buy silver is pretty. I mean, if you're £70,000 in debt, as we just heard the student suggesting, you're not in a position to buy any silver.
If you can, yes. Would it make any difference to withdraw your money from the bank or to buy silver?
Well, buying silver might make a difference because, as JP Morgan have basically tried to corner the silver market, so Keiser is suggesting that people should make sure that JP Morgan burns their fingers. And if it was successful, and Eric Cantona's suggestion of people withdrawing money from the banks, that would in fact weaken the banks if it was successful. I think it's about time that we had a really hard look at what the banks actually get up to. And I think anything that brings people to put their attention on what banks actually do is a necessary thing. But we're going to have to reform that whole system.
Anyway, on English language channel, Freeview channel, Russia Today and satellite channel, Max Keiser is also asking people to post up their own YouTube videos on the internet advertising his campaign to buy silver and crash JP Morgan. One bright spark has made a spoof video with Jackie Onassis, a former wife of former US President John F. Kennedy, a puppet of Jackie Onassis telling viewers to buy silver, crash JP Morgan. Here's Max.
Yeah, you know, the thing about the Jackie O video also is that, interesting, she makes reference to JFK, who Executive Order 11110 back in 1963 was going to reintroduce silver and silver certificates as a challenge to the Federal Reserve banking system. Shortly thereafter, JFK was assassinated. A lot of people postulate that those two events are linked. Certainly, what we've seen in the last 2 years, Stacey Herbert, with Hank Paulson before Congress saying to Congress, give us $750 billion or we're going to kill you, was his message, his subtext. He threatened to kill the members of Congress unless they forked over $750 billion, according to testimony that was later talked about of the Congress folks in the backroom deals. We know that they're serious about their paper currency. They're willing to commit homicide. They're willing to take out a standing president for their paper currency Ponzi schemes. So this is a powerful force we're talking about. For every ounce of silver you buy, it's like putting another silver nail in the coffin of J.P. Morgan, one of the probably the biggest financial terrorists in the world today.
Now, Martin, is Max Keiser's accusation there about this being a possible motive for the assassination of John F. Kennedy, is that true?
There were various possible motives. That might be one of them. Others were to do with the military-industrial complex and also Israel's nuclear weapons. I think we need, as I mentioned a moment ago, we need to reform the financial system. And that means that people have to understand how it operates and what kind of things need to be done to reform it. I mean, on this programme, in previous weeks, we've had people talking about currency reform, and I believe in currency reform, but it's not. But we need other things as well as currency reform. But we need to start talking about these things, absolutely.
Well, we have been in former weeks, and if you go onto our podcast page on the internet, which is www.thisweek.org.uk, you can hear them all there. Several years ago, former US NBC television business reporter Daniel Hopsicker left television because he couldn't tell some of the stories, particularly the stories about the links between intelligence services and drug gangs that he wanted to, on the mainstream media. He went on to make a series of investigative documentaries only available on DVD and on the internet. He's one of the most incisive, accurate and engaging independent journalists in the world right now. So here is the opening to his film about the US banking conspiracy, entitled Masters of the Universe.
Thomas Jefferson wrote, "If the American people ever allow the banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children will wake up homeless on the continents their fathers occupied."
See, what the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 did was give this private banking cartel a total monopoly of printing money. So what you had here was a complete takeover of the government of the United States by these private bankers. They've owned it ever since.
100 years after Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln was pondering the same issues when he said, "The government should create, issue, and circulate all the currency. Creating and issuing money is the supreme prerogative of government and its greatest creative opportunity. Adopting these principles will save the taxpayers immense sums of interest, and money will cease to be the master and become the servant of humanity."
Every $100 bill, which the Federal Reserve System prints and is sold to the United States at full face value, represents a $100 loan. Even though the government pays for it, they still pay interest, and it becomes, that's what your $4 trillion debt is, are the Federal Reserve notes.
What do the fears expressed by Jefferson and Lincoln have to do with today's murmurings about something called the New World Order?
And incidentally, it was Woodrow Wilson who first proclaimed the New World Order. It was the creation of the Federal Reserve that put the cap on this whole revolution, because that's what it was.
And that was Daniel Hopsicker from his film Masters of the Universe, talking to some former bankers and others about the Masters of the Universe. So, the BBC has been in a lot of trouble recently, having to apologise for inaccurate stories, and so-called journalist Mark Urban on Newsnight last week forgot to mention that South Korea was conducting a live firing exercise right on the disputed border with North Korea on last Tuesday's exchange of fire. Over the last couple of days, and in fact last week actually, the BBC have been announcing joint military manoeuvres with 20,000 US troops stationed in South Korea, as if these manoeuvres had not been going on before the North Koreans opened fire the previous week. Anyway, the Bard of Windmill Hill, Trevor Carter, has come up with a poem last week on the dialect programme at noon on Sunday, all about the BBC. So here is last week a little repeat of Trevor Carter's poem.
"Used for putting out some slanderous views about Sir Bob and his fine deeds. such tittle-tattle spreads like weeds, and many thought it true, you see, as it came from the BBC. Yes, standards fall in modern times when news reporters are inclined not to question, is it true? But just to think, oh, this'll do, let's go ahead and put it out. They do not entertain their doubt. A pity about the BBC. Many people I talk to agree that it has gone the modern way and let its standards go astray. Its bosses in their ivory towers misuse our cash, abuse their powers. It is no longer in top gear. It's lost its way. That much is clear. Producing dross now seems its goal. Jeremy Clarkson, one sick soul. While women are sacked for being old, can this be true? It is, I'm told. So I suggest to make things better, they could take notice of this letter. Give jobs to poets such as me. I am not proud. I work for free. I'm sitting waiting for the call. I've nothing else to do at all.
That was the Bard of Windmill Hill, Trevor Carter there, and his poem, which was on last weekend on Sunday's dialect programme, which goes out at 12 noon. Well, that's just about it then. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, who was Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Health and Inequality, John Rogers. And also to University of the West of England students up at Frenchae, to Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth, to reporter Marina Morris, who was vox-popping around this week, as usual, and of course to our resident old Labour economist, Martin Summers. Next week, that report from US security expert and retired FBI war crimes prosecutor at last, John Loftus, which was delayed from 2 weeks ago. And that's enough talk for tonight, because Friday night is music night. At 8, it's Dan and Matt's Erotic Toast Project. At 9, it's Permission to Dance with Joss and James. And top of the bill at 10, it's Mash Up to the Weekend, woven together by DJ Spungold. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's five-point economic recovery plan, a report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, an extended interview with managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as our fifth anniversary investigation into the 7/7 London bombings. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't let the banksters get you down.
It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol